The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated January 30/February 6, 2023. It is, as usual, bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow inner border of white. Time, T-I-M-E, is in large block capital letters in black, superimposed upon a sky blue coloration of the majority of the cover. There are lips in bright red painted here, or printed, with teeth like a zipper. They look somewhat like misaligned real teeth, but they're the teeth of a zipper with the zipper pull, with a smiley face at the edge of the zipper pull, and it's white against the bright red lips and the bright sky blue background, and it says, "Zip It, The Power of Saying Less," by Dan Lyons, which will be our lead article. Overtalkers Are Everywhere, But Saying Less Will Get You More, by Dan Lyons. This is under the heading Society. The world is filled with overtalkers. You run into them all the time. They are that pest at the office who destroys every Monday by recounting each unremarkable thing they did over the weekend. They are the jerk who talks over everyone else at a dinner party while the rest of you fantasize about slipping hemlock into the pinot noir. They're the neighbor who drops in uninvited and spends an hour telling you stories you've already heard. The arrogant know-it-all who interrupts colleagues in meetings. The CEO whose reckless tweet gets him charged with securities fraud. And don't get me started on the British prince who incessantly uses the press to spread his message, criticizing the press. To be honest, they are most of us, too. It is not entirely our fault. We live in a world that does not just encourage overtalking, but practically demands it, where success is measured by how much attention we can attract. Get a million Twitter followers, become an Instagram influencer, make a viral video, give a TED talk. We are inundated with YouTube, social media, chat apps, streaming services. Did you know there are more than 2 million podcasts which have produced 48 million episodes? Or that more than 3,000 TEDx events take place every year, with up to 20 wannabe Malcolm Gladwells participating in each one? Or that Americans sit through more than a billion meetings a year, but think that half are a complete waste of time? We are tweeting for the sake of tweeting, talking for the sake of talking, yet many of the most powerful and successful people do the exact opposite. Instead of seeking attention, they hold back. When they do speak, they are careful about what they say. Apple CEO Tim Cook lets awkward pauses hang during conversations. For 4 decades, Joe Biden was the king of gaffes. But in 2020, he found the campaign trail discipline to keep his voice low and his answers short, to pause between speaking and give boring answers. Now he's president. Albert Einstein was an introvert who cherished solitude. The late Ruth Bader Ginsburg chose her words so carefully and took such painfully long pauses that her clerks developed a habit they called the two Mississippi rule. Finish what you are saying and then count one Mississippi, two Mississippi, before you speak again. The justice was not ignoring you. She was thinking very deeply about how to respond. Most of us will not get appointed to the Supreme Court or become tech billionaires, but we can prevail in our own day-to-day battles, buying a new car or house, hoping to move up the ladder at work, trying to win friends and influence people. Learn how to shut the F up. Men in particular are the champions of over-talking and talking over. We bulldoze, we hog the floor, we mansplain, we manterrupt, deliver monologues. To me, this is a personal problem. I am an inveterate over-talker, and it has cost me dearly. The issue is not only that I talk too much, it is that I have never been able to resist blurting out inappropriate things, and I cannot keep my opinions to myself. Once when I put my foot in my mouth at work, I lost my job and the promise of millions of dollars. Worse, my lack of conversational impulse control led to a separation from my wife and nearly cost me my marriage. It was then, living alone in a rented house, away from my wife and kids, that I conducted what members of Alcoholics Anonymous call a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, and acknowledged that in ways big and small, over-talking was interfering with my life. This sent me on a search to find the answers to two questions. Why are some people compulsive talkers, and how can we fix it? Early on in my process, I discovered there is a word for my problem, talkaholism, a term coined by a pair of communication studies scholars to describe a form of extreme over-talking. They created a self-scored questionnaire to identify people who suffer from the condition. Find that quiz at time.com/talk. I got 50 points on the talkaholic scale, the highest possible score. My wife, Sasha, gave me the same 50 points and probably wished she could give me more. This was not unexpected, but according to Virginia P. Richmond and James C. McCroskey, the West Virginia University research who developed the test in 1993, this might be cause for concern. They described talkaholism as an addiction and said that while a talkaholic's gift with words can help them advance in their careers, their inability to rein in their over-talking can lead to personal and professional difficulties. Check, check, and check. Talkaholics cannot just wake up one day and choose to talk less. Their talking is compulsive. They do not talk just a little bit more than everyone else, but a lot more. And they do this all the time, in every context or setting, even when they know other people think they talk too much. Here is the gut punch. Talkaholics continue to talk even when they know that what they are about to say is going to hurt them. They simply cannot stop. "That's me," I said to Sasha. "Right, that's totally me. I've been telling you this for years," she said. We were sitting in the kitchen. Our kids, 15-year-old twins, were not home. Memories flew around in my brain, times when I blurted out something off color at a party, or embarrassed the kids by talking someone's ear off, or regaled them with unsolicited advice instead of asking them how they were or what they needed. Danalogues, we called them, and we'd laugh and pretend it was funny. You know how Dad loves to talk. But now, looking at these test results in black and white, I do not feel like laughing. I felt embarrassed and worried. My search for answers brought me to Michael Beatty, a professor who once worked with Richmond and McCroskey and now teaches at the University of Miami. Richmond told me, Beatty was the best person to talk to about the research that had been done since the talkaholic scale was introduced. It is biology, Beatty told me when we got on the phone. It is all nature, not nurture. It starts to develop prenatally. 20 years ago, he pioneered a field called communobiology, which studies communication as a biological phenomenon. Instead of teaching courses in journalism and public speaking, the traditional business of a university communication department, he collaborated with neuroscientists, giving study participants EEGs to measure their brain waves and sticking them into fMRI machines to watch their brains light up when they looked at pictures or listened to audio recordings. A lot of communication researchers thought he was going down a blind alley, but Beatty was sure he was right. To me, it would be weird if the way we communicate was not related to the brain, he said. We just didn't know how. In 2010, Beatty and his colleagues discovered that talkativeness is linked to brainwave imbalances. Specifically, it is about the balance between neuron activity in the left and right lobes in the anterior region of the prefrontal cortex. Ideally, the left and right lobe should have about the same amount of neuronal activity when a person is at rest. If there is an asymmetry, if your left side's more active than the right, you are likely to be shy. If the right side is more active, you are likely to be talkative. The greater the imbalance, the further out on the talkativeness spectrum you will tend to be. A talkaholic's right lobe will fire a ton, while the left side barely flickers. It is all about impulse control, Beatty told me. The brain imbalances he studies have also been shown to correspond to aggression, and your ability to assess how a plan might unfold and what the consequences will be. The right dominant lack of impulse control, the same factor that might make it so hard to zip your lips, often plays out in the workplace. If I am right side dominant and I'm a CEO and I'm in a meeting where some employees start saying dumb things, I'm not going to be polite. I'm going to get angry and tell them to shut up, Beatty said. Unfortunately, Beatty, Richmond, and McCroskey all came to the same conclusion in their research. A talkaholic can't just quit. After all, Beatty argues, you cannot simply zap your neurons back into balance. It is not completely deterministic, but there's very little room to change who you are, he told me. This, of course, was not the answer I wanted to hear. I wanted to be a better spouse, parent, and friend. I wanted to stop dreading social events and mitigate my risk of blowing up my job. There might not be a cure for talkaholism, but there is no cure either for alcoholism, and yet some alcoholics develop the discipline to stop drinking. I could not afford a speech coach. I could not find any online courses that teach you how to stop over-talking. So after connecting with Beatty, I struck out on my own, interviewing dozens of people who in one way or another are experts on speech. Historians, social scientists, political scientists, communication professors, executive coaches, psychologists. Some research suggests that silence might help us grow new brain cells, so I went forest bathing in the Berkshires. I took an online listening course. A psychologist in California shared with me the techniques she teaches to prisoners to help them keep their mouths shut during parole hearings and non-talk their way out of prison. Methods I hoped would help me break free from my compulsion. Armed with theory, advice, and exercises, I developed guidelines for myself and started practicing them. I bailed out of social media almost entirely. I trained myself to become comfortable with uncomfortable silences. Before picking up the phone or getting on a Zoom call, I took deep breaths to slow myself down, using the heart rate monitor on my Apple Watch to see whether this was working, and jotting down notes on the purpose of the conversation so I could stick to the agenda. During the call, I would lower my voice and slow my cadence. I attached a piece of paper to the wall above my computer screen with admonishments. In 60-point type, quiet, listen, short answers, wrap it up. I asked my kids open-ended questions, then sat back and let them speak. Officially speaking, we were having a talk, but in truth, I was having a listen. For most of us, talking is like breathing. You don't think about it, you just do it. But when you start paying attention to how you speak, this leads you to think about why you speak the way you do. You're forcing yourself to become conscious of something that usually happens unconsciously. Now you're doing the kind of work you might do with meditation or psychotherapy. You are turning your attention inward. You are engaging in self-reflection and self-examination. You are figuring out who you are. Gradually, I began to develop more discipline, and as I did, something extraordinary happened. I started to feel better, both emotionally and physically. I am not perfect, and I cannot always adhere to my own rules, but when I do, the results are magical. I feel calmer, less anxious, more in control, which makes me less likely to overtalk. It is a positive feedback loop. The less I talk, the less I talk. Better yet, I see the effect on the people around me. My marriage is stronger than ever. My daughter and I sit on the porch every evening and have long conversations filled with laughter. If you're the parent of a high school-age kid, you know how miraculous this feels. She tells me her dreams and what she thinks she might want to do with her life. She tells me about her fears and doubts. Instead of trying to solve her problems, I listen. Inevitably, she works her way around to solving them herself and concludes she's going to be all right and that she knows what she needs to do. I discover she has never felt confident playing Mozart and Haydn on the piano, and that now she's going to a summer camp where she will have to play Haydn in a trio, she is freaking out. She fears she might not be able to do it, but at the same time, she'd rather try and fail than chicken out. I discover that I don't just admire her, but that I'm inspired by her. I hear her. I hear all the people in my life who matter deeply to me. And now, when I do speak, they are ready to listen. Dan Lyons, the author of this article, is the author of STFU, The Power of Keeping Your Mouth Shut in an Endlessly Noisy World, from which this essay is adapted. Now, here are five short points. The top of the column is stated how to stop overtalking. One, when possible, say nothing. Pretend words are money and spend them wisely. Be Dirty Harry, not Prince Harry. Two, master the power of the pause. Take a breath. Wait. Let the other person process what you have said. 3. Quit social media. The first cousin of over-talking is over-tweeting. If you cannot quit completely, at least dial it way back. 4. Seek out silence. Detach, unplug. Giving your brain a rest can kickstart your creativity. 5. Learn how to listen. Instead of just hearing someone, practice active listening. Pay fierce attention to the other person. We Hold the Pen of History by Christiana Figueres. More than at any other time in the history of human presence on this planet, we are now deciding what our own future will be. Since the last ice age, some 12,000 years ago, humans have been able to develop civilization as we know it, thanks to the stability of the Earth's interconnected ecosystems, which cradled life and supported our expansion. During this era, the Holocene, humans flourished, but nature reigned. We were the thriving recipients of a favorable environment unique in the history of the planet. But around 1950, the situation changed. We moved from being the passive recipients to being the direct driving force behind transformation in our natural environment, and not for the better. We now exercise such control over the planet that we have catapulted it and ourselves into a new geological era known as the Anthropocene, the human-shaped epoch, in which the pen of history has been passed from nature to humanity, and we are the ones determining what will be written. In just 70 short years, we collectively ignored all the scientific warnings about the dangers that would ensue. Decades of extraction and overconsumption, the accumulation of great wealth in small pockets of society, and general disregard for our role as guardians of the global commons have altered the Earth's atmosphere, land, and oceans so substantially we are literally living ourselves out of our life-providing environment. This is the most perilous moment in human history. That is the clear message from the latest scientific reports, which are categorical in warning us of looming radical changes in the Earth's systems that have so far been keeping us safe. Our planet will, of course, continue on her evolutionary path, started 4.5 billion years ago, but the human effects of those tipping points would render many parts of our globe uninhabitable to the human race, with all the attending economic, social, health, political, and security consequences. The resulting turbulence would be unprecedented and irreversible. Facing this stark reality with our eyes wide open, we must make an immediate choice. Most of us can feel deep in our bones that transformational change is needed, and science has made abundantly clear what it must entail. To protect ourselves, we have to protect 1.5 degrees centigrade as our maximum global average temperature increase. That means we have to make two things happen this decade. First, we have to cut our global greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030. Second, we have to safeguard all remaining healthy ecosystems, regenerating those we have depleted. If we do not meet this dual challenge, we basically condemn ourselves and our descendants to a world of ever-increasing climate chaos, spiraling destruction, and deepening human misery. However, if we do choose to cut our emissions by 50% by 2030, which is technically entirely feasible, and act decisively to protect nature, we open the portal to a world that not only averts the worst of climate change, but is actually a much better one than we have the right now. A better one than we have right now, with better public health, more livable cities, more efficient transport, more productive land. Without a doubt, we are in the decisive decade. We must be guided by the firm conviction humans can meet this challenge. We must change the unfolding story of the Anthropocene from one of overconsumption, inequality, and destruction to one of repair, regeneration, and reconnection against all apparent odds. We must constantly remind ourselves we are holding the pen. We must stand tall in our unwavering faith in human ingenuity and compassion, reminding ourselves of our individual and collective agency carving a better future does not happen on its own. We have to be intentional, purpose-driven, frankly downright stubborn about our objective. Only that determination will give us a fighting chance. Christiana Figueres, who wrote this, is co-host of the Climate Podcast, Outrage Plus Optimism, and former executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Time off, movies. Reviews now by Stephanie Zakarik. Two literary giants duke it out. It is hard to make a good movie about the act of writing. It is even harder to make a movie about the work of editors, whose main job is to read and read with empathy and acumen. Yet Lizzie Gottlieb has made a splendid documentary that captures the quicksilver essence of these conjoined pursuits. Turn Every Page, The Adventures of Robert Caro and Robert Gottlieb, is an adventure story, albeit one in which the heroes spend most of their time sitting down. Gottlieb, the director's father, is one of the most acclaimed editors of his generation, having helped bring books like Catch-22, Beloved, and True Grit into being. He was also the editor of the first book by former newspaperman Robert Caro, a meticulously researched biography of the mighty urban planner Robert Moses. The Power Broker, published in 1974, was an immediate success and an almost instant classic. Caro's next undertaking, a biography of President Lyndon B. Johnson, has stretched to 5 volumes. Caro, now 87, is working on the final one, as Gottlieb, 91, awaits the manuscript. Turn Every Page whisks through their careers, with luminaries like David Remnick and Colm Tóibín weighing in, but its most delightful moments revel in the prickly yet deeply respectful relationship between two unassuming giants. Who knew watching two guys duke it out over syntax and semicolons could be this gripping? Another review by Sakarik. There's a photo here of a young man. He's dressed in a green school jacket. He's apparently got a backpack on because he's holding on to straps of something that is not seen in the photo. He's wearing a rusty-colored knit cap, and he has long shoulder-length dark hair flowing beneath the cap. Now, next to him is a blonde woman. She's strawberry blonde, and her hair is probably parted in the center, but it's long and flowing, well past her shoulders. She's wearing gold-colored, wire-rimmed glasses, and she's looking at the taller, younger man. The woman in this photo reminds me of Mia Farrow from, I'll say, 30 or 40 years ago, but it isn't. Review. A mother and son out of tune with one another. Nobody uses the term generation gap anymore, but the problems it refers to are eternal. And they are the core of When You Finish Saving the World, Jesse Eisenberg's debut as a writer-director. Finn Wolfhard is Ziggy Katz, a teenage singer-songwriter, who is a mini-sensation in his corner of the Internet, cultivating an audience of loyal followers with his folky songs about youthful love and angst. But his mother, Evelyn, Julianne Moore, the harried founder and manager of a women's shelter, downgrades both his enterprise and his talents. And his father, Roger J. O. Sanders, is a checked-out academic type whose nose is always buried in a book or a magazine. The clash between mother and son is particularly acute. Evelyn just wishes her son were somehow different, in ways she cannot even define. When a particularly smart and sensitive teenager Billy Burke's Kyle moves into the shelter with his mother, Evelyn takes him on as a personal project, encouraging him to apply for college scholarships, even though he has his sights on being a mechanic, a job he's exceptionally good at. Ziggy is so frustrated with his mother that he doesn't even realize he's been shunted aside. He is also distracted by his crush on a schoolmate, Alicia Bowes Lila, a budding political activist. She's a passionate, yet plodding, spinner of rhetoric, no match for the awkward romantic poet in him. These are the gentle interwoven tensions that hold when you finish saving the world together, albeit just barely. There are times when the movie leans a little too hard on Moore, as the chilly, clueless mom, a woman who still sees herself as an idealistic hippie, though she's the exact opposite of laid back. Even the way she swirls her Malbec in the goblet, unwinding after a stressful day at the shelter, is uptight. Yet Eisenberg is a thoughtful filmmaker, devoted to showing his characters as multidimensional, flawed human beings. This is a modest film, but not a superficial one. The point, maybe, is that parents and children sometimes have to lose each other for a while before finding accord. The space between them is not so much a gap, but a cycle of reconnection, played out one generation after another. And another review by Stephanie Zakarik. The best of times and the worst of times, all at the same time. Soon enough, most adults must reckon with their parents' physical and mental vulnerabilities. And it is always a blow. Writer-director Mia Hansen-Love's, delicately shaded, One Fine Morning deals with the wrenchingly mundane nature of caring for those who used to take care of us. But it is also about the difficulty and the necessity of tending to our own emotional lives, even as we are looking after others. That sounds so simple, you might not think it is enough to fill a whole movie, yet the end of One Fine Morning imparts a sense of life spilling over. The way its strange, radiant richness is often too much to analyze in the moment. This is a big movie served up in a surprisingly small, intimate package. Léa Seydoux is Sandra, a translator living in Paris with her 8-year-old daughter, Lynn, Camille Lebon-Martins. Her husband's been dead for several years. She is so devoted to her daughter and her work that she has not given any thought to finding someone new. She runs into an old friend, Clément Melville Poupon, a scientist, and after a pleasant platonic dinner, he quizzes her about the state of things. "I just feel my love life is behind me," she answers. Clément is married with a child of his own, and he is not trying to put the moves on Sandra, at least not yet, but he gives her a look that can barely be summed up in words, not pity, but a sad acknowledgement of another human's lost opportunity. Before long, the two of them have tumbled into an illicit romance, and something inside Sandra kicks back to life. But this sudden happiness is just a side note. Sandra's father, Georg Pascal Gregory, suffers from a neurodegenerative disease that has already robbed him of his sight and is now increasingly blurring his mind. A former philosophy professor whose life has always revolved around reading, he now spends his days alone in his book-lined apartment, a thirsty man surrounded by water he cannot drink. You also get the sense he has always been a little remote as a father, to begin with. But that does not lessen the severity of the crisis when it is determined he can no longer live on his own. Sandra finds herself in the position of struggling to do the right thing by a father who almost literally now looks right through her. Sandra herself seems to be in a bit of a nowhere zone, a place of transition she cannot seem to fight her way out of. Hanson Lives Best Movies, Father of My Children, Eden, are quiet but sturdy reflections on people stuck in between, people who do not seem to realize or have forgotten that the in-between is really all there is. One fine morning is in a league with these pictures, and Sedu, with her watchful eyes and cautious smile, is perfect as a woman who once knew her way but has somehow lost it. Late in the film, as Sandra goes about divesting Georg's beloved library, giving it much of it away to an adoring former student, she remarks she feels closer to her father with his books than she does when she's physically with him. There is his bodily envelope, here his soul. In this movie about how the best times in our lives are sometimes entwined with the worst, that state of uneasy grace is as close as you can get to a happy ending. Russia's War Costs the Whole World by Sergei Marchenko, who is Ukraine's finance minister. A year ago, Ukraine's economy was on a strong footing, with a debt to GDP of less than 50%. And a budget deficit of 3.5%. Then came February 24, and with it, a full-scale war. We were in a new reality with very different financial needs. Funds that should have been directed toward environmental, social, and corporate governance goals, sustainable development, and strengthening the country's competitiveness were redirected to defense, humanitarian purposes, and support for people affected by the war. And in 2023, about 50% of the state budget is allocated to national security and defense. Months of war have transformed Ukraine from a country with stable and promising financial indicators to one that's directing all resources to the struggle while battling severe economic consequences. 30% economic decline, inflation around 28%, up to 8 million refugees, unemployment of about 30%, hundreds of destroyed or damaged businesses and industries. Since the start of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by the Russian Federation, we've been implementing measures for macroeconomic stabilization and accumulation of financial resources to defend our state. While business in Ukraine was practically paralyzed in the first month of the war, we've ensured that today just 10% of enterprises are non-functioning, and our economic and financial systems are fully operational. The financial system has performed at full capacity since the invasion. Budget revenues have increased by 20% since April. We began issuing war bonds. All social expenditures, pensions, wages of teachers and health care workers, as well as the security and defense sector, have been financed. At the beginning of the Russian invasion, international partners verified our budget deficit at $5 billion per month for the rest of 2022. As of early December, we had received just over $28 billion out of that required $50 billion, and the National Bank of Ukraine had to print $12 billion more. In 2023, the state budget deficit of Ukraine will reach $38 billion. The constant massive missile attacks across Ukraine mean the construction bill and economic losses will keep growing in 2023. The support of international partners will play a crucial role in how we get through the 2023 budget year. We welcome the U.S. intention to continue providing grants to Ukraine, as well as the European Commission's proposal to launch a new full-scale macro-financial assistance program for Ukraine in 2023. But as the war drags on, this is not enough. Large economies and international financial institutions need to find new tools and solutions, not just for Ukraine, When a country finds itself under attack, it needs fully engaged and constant cooperation. Learning from the experience of military aid coordination at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and to coordinate financial support to Ukraine and address immediate financial needs, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal have proposed a new financial coordination platform. The idea of developing this platform is to bring G7 member countries and international financial institutions to the table on a regular basis to facilitate information sharing on key developments and projections, as well as ensure timely and efficient channeling of the financial assistance from various donors. This kind of cooperation will help to make disbursement more efficient. With Ukraine as a co-chair, the platform could develop effective and sustainable mechanisms to coordinate financial support for Ukraine, as well as a valuable model for other nations to use in the future. Russia's war does not just affect Ukraine's economy. The economic consequences have been global. Many countries are facing the highest inflation in decades, huge energy costs, threats of recession. Food security and an energy crisis will bring many more deaths and suffering around the world. We must work more closely toward a solution for us all. Social Media's Perspective Pitfall by Tristan Harris. Harris is co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology and co-host of the podcast Your Undivided Attention. Cooperation, the thing we need most to solve big problems in the world, is being collapsed by the thing that promised to connect us and bring us closer, social media. The problem is social connection is not actually the business model. Engagement is. Social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, and more, make choices to show us, the users, content that is most engaging. Unfortunately, what is most engaging is not always aligned with what we value. What gets the most engagement, follows, shares, comments, are the fights, takedowns, proverbial car crashes we cannot take our eyes from. Seeing more divisive content pushes us further into polarized ways of thinking on every topic, which spills over into our offline lives and makes cooperation a taller and taller task. Yet today's world requires unprecedented levels of coordination and cooperation to meet unprecedented challenges. Whether it's climate change, reducing crime, how to harness and keep humanity safe in increasingly AI-driven realities, our most pressing problems depend upon a shared reality. There's an image on this page that shows how a 3D cylinder can cast a 2D shadow that can look like either a square or a circle, depending upon the light's angle. The simple visual experiment demonstrates the power of one's point of view. There's kind of a short, chopped-off cylinder in the center of this illustration. The end is green. The wraparound part is blue. Then projected on either side, as if this little short cylinder were in a corner, is a blue-surrounded black square, and facing it, a green-surrounded black circle. If we focus from one angle, the 3D cylinder shadow looks like a 2D square. But if you look from the other angle, the cylinder shadow looks like a 2D circle. People standing on either side might fight back and forth, yelling more and more loudly at each other over which 2D shape is true, increasingly convinced the other side's wrong. Meanwhile, they'd be missing the higher dimensional cylinder, which requires synthesizing multiple perspectives. Today's social media is designed in a way that rewards us for arguing in 2D about 3D issues, seeing the world in squares and circles. Narrowly framed debates about circles and squares do not actually resolve our 3D problems. Take the issue of climate change. 2D squares, circles ask, is climate change really an existential risk or overblown media hype? While the 3D cylinder perspective question remains, what trade-offs do we collectively want between economic growth, energy needs, global security, and emissions required for that growth? Additionally, the classic social media debate between free speech and censorship is a circle-square debate. Should platforms allow free speech? Or should platforms moderate content to keep users safe? Which is right, the circle or the square? Or can we ask a 3D cylinder question? What kind of information ecosystem, design, and incentives will reward the most good faith marketplace of ideas? For example, for all the talk of Twitter as a public square, there is a big difference between the speech rewarded if that public square is designed like a Roman Colosseum that incentivizes violence and chaos compared with the speech rewarded by a Quaker meeting that incentivizes reflection. Cylindrical perspectives allow for nuance and promote a synthesis of ideas, not merely consensus or tyranny of the masses, but a merging of ideas into a Venn diagram of agreement. By taking a cylinder view, we learn we actually can discuss complex topics and reach cooperative solutions required in democratic societies. Technology is made up of design choices. Engagement as a business model produced choices that have gotten us into the 2D situation we are in. But we can make new design choices. Software is malleable. We can rebuild existing technology and design new ones with a more humane philosophy that strengthens our capacities for synthesis and cooperation. Rather than fall into the trap of 2D debates on this issue of free speech versus content moderation, we can take a collaborative 3D perspective. Change will not be easy, but the cooperation we need to tackle all of our other existential challenges is at stake. Okay, the next article is called Machine Learning. But then learning is stamped out and warning is placed on top of it. DeepMind CEO helped take AI mainstream. Now he's urging caution, by Billy Perigo, London, with reporting by Mariah Espada and Solcier Burga. Now this is a long article, which will almost surely be abridged. Demis Hassabis stands halfway up a spiral staircase, surveying the cathedral he built. Behind him, light glints off the rungs of a golden helix, rising up through the staircase's airy well. The DNA sculpture, spanning three floors, is the centerpiece of DeepMind's recently opened London headquarters. DeepMind is combined to make one word. It is an artistic representation of the code embedded in the nucleus of nearly every cell in the human body. Although we work on making machines smart, we wanted to keep humanity at the center of what we are doing here, Hassabis, DeepMind CEO and co-founder, tells Time. This building, he says, is a cathedral to knowledge. Each meeting room is named after a famous scientist or philosopher. I have always thought of DeepMind as an ode to intelligence, he says. Hassabis, 46, has always been obsessed with intelligence. What it is, the possibilities it unlocks, how to acquire more of it. He was the second best chess player in the world for his age when he was 12. He graduated from high school a year early. As an adult, he strikes a somewhat diminutive figure, but his intellectual presence fills the room. I want to understand the big questions, the really big ones, that you normally go into philosophy or physics if you're interested in, he says. I thought building AI would be the fastest route to answer some of those questions. DeepMind, a subsidiary of Google's parent company Alphabet, is one of the world's leading artificial intelligence labs. Last summer, it announced that one of its algorithms, AlphaFold, had predicted the 3D structures of nearly all the proteins known to humanity, and that the company was making the technology behind it freely available. Scientists had long been familiar with the sequences of amino acids that make up proteins, the building blocks of life, but had never cracked how they fold up into the complex 3D shapes so crucial to their behavior in the human body. AlphaFold has already been a force multiplier for hundreds of thousands of scientists working on efforts such as developing malaria vaccines, fighting antibiotic resistance, tackling plastic pollution, the company says. Now DeepMind is applying a similar machine learning technique to the puzzle of nuclear fission, hoping it helps yield an abundant source of cheap, zero-carbon energy that could wean the global economy off fossil fuels at a critical juncture in the climate crisis. Hassabis says these efforts are just the beginning. He and his colleagues have been working toward a much grander ambition, creating artificial general intelligence, or AGI, by building machines that can think, learn, and be set to solve humanity's toughest problems. Today, AI is narrow, brittle, and often not very intelligent at all. But AGI, Hassabis believes, will be an epoch-defining technology, like harnessing electricity, that will change the very fabric of human life. If he's right, it could earn him a place in history. But with AI's promise also comes peril. In recent months, researchers building an AI system to design new drugs revealed their tool could be easily repurposed to make deadly new chemicals. A separate AI model trained to spew out toxic hate speech went viral, exemplifying the risk to vulnerable communities online. And inside AI labs around the world, policy experts have grappled with near-term questions like what to do when an AI has the potential to be commandeered by rogue states to mount widespread hacking campaigns or infer state-level nuclear secrets. In December 2022, ChatGPT, a chatbot designed by OpenAI, went viral for its ability to write almost like a human, but faced criticism for its susceptibility to racism and misinformation. And the tiny company Prisma Labs went viral for its Lensa app's AI-enhanced selfies. Many users complained Lensa sexualized their images, revealing biases in its training data. What was once a field of a few deep-pocketed tech companies is becoming increasingly accessible. As computing power becomes cheaper and AI techniques become better known, you no longer need a high-walled cathedral to perform cutting-edge research. It is in this uncertain climate that Hassabis agrees to a rare interview to issue a stark warning about his growing concerns. I would advocate not moving fast and breaking things, he says, referring to an old Facebook motto that encouraged engineers to release their technologies first and fix problems later. The phrase has since become synonymous with disruption. That culture, subsequently emulated by a generation of startups, helped Facebook rocket to 3 billion users, but it also left the company entirely unprepared when disinformation, hate speech, and even incitement to genocide began appearing on its platform. Hassaba sees a similarly worrying trend developing with AI. He says AI is now on the cusp of being able to make tools that could be deeply damaging to human civilization, and urges his competitors to proceed with more caution than before. When it comes to very powerful technologies, and obviously AI is going to be one of the most powerful ever, we need to be careful, he says. Not everybody's thinking about those things. It's like experimentalists, many of whom do not realize they're holding dangerous material. Worse still, Hassabis points out, we are the guinea pigs. Finishing now with the last paragraph of this article, back at DeepMind's spiral staircase, an employee explains the DNA sculpture is designed to rotate. But today, the motor's broken. Closer inspection shows some of the rungs of the helix are askew. At the bottom of the staircase, there is a notice on a wooden stool in front of this giant metaphor for humanity. Please don't touch, it reads. It's very fragile and could easily be damaged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.